Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. One problem spot on Valley Freeways, and it's north of the Valley. I-17 southbound, there's a collision blocking the exit ramp at State Route 74. Look for partly sunny skies for the rest of the day, the high reaching up to 109. That would be 9 degrees warmer than average. Clear skies tonight, lows near 80, up to 114 tomorrow, 116 on Saturday. Right now, under sunny skies, it's 100 degrees.
If you happen to be awake very early this morning, a little before 4 o'clock, you probably saw something unexpected in the dark sky. KJZZ's Catherine Fritke was one of them, and rather than turning around and driving home, she decided to come into work and learn more. So, Catherine, where were you and what did you see?
Well, this morning I was driving southbound on the Loop 101 just before 4, as you said, and the sky just kept getting brighter and brighter, like the sun was rising really quickly. That's when I looked around and saw to my left a ball of fire break into pieces, and then I heard a really loud boom. And because of the myth of the Phoenix Lights, one of my first thoughts was aliens. But it wasn't aliens, and the suspected meteor that I thought was falling over my head was actually falling much further away. I spoke with Lawrence Garvey, the curator of Arizona State University's Center for Meteorite Studies. He says I wasn't alone in thinking the ball of fire was closer than it was.
The fireball flash that you usually see happens many tens of miles up in the atmosphere, that big flash that everyone's reporting to have seen. But it's almost like an optical illusion. They think, oh, it's just over the horizon. It's just a few miles away down the road. That's where it would almost certainly have fallen. But actually, since that fireball flash is, you know, starts at like 50, 60, 70 miles up in the atmosphere, it's actually much, much further away in the distance than one realizes.
He told me that their intel indicates the meteor fell in the eastern part of Arizona near the community of Cibicue off the Fort Apache Reservation.
Some of our researchers and colleagues at NASA have been looking at the Doppler radar returns from that part of Arizona, and it looks like there's almost certainly some stones on the ground.
Garvey says the next steps are looking for the possible items that did land. He says Doppler radar has provided them with X marks the spot clarity.
From a scientific point of view, you know, this looks quite exciting. As the curator for a Center for Meteorite Studies, this looks like quite an exciting event. The chances of something being found from the data that we have so far are relatively good. I know various meteorite hunters that I know of have packed their trucks and are driving as we speak.
That was Lawrence Garvey with the ASU Center for Meteorite Studies on this morning's cosmic events and what to expect next.
And that's KJZZ's Catherine Fritke. Catherine, thanks.
Thank you.
The Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention report nearly 600 travel-associated cases of Zika virus in the U.S. as of May 25th. Three of those were in Arizona. New York and Florida had the most cases. A University of Arizona researcher is part of a team looking into which American cities could be at high risk for Zika. Casey Ernst is an associate professor in epidemiology in the College of Public Health at U of A. Casey, how exactly do you define which are those high-risk areas?
What we were really trying to do is take a first cut at trying to identify where we might have transmission of Zika if we have it in the United States. And the three components that the paper included were the seasonality of Aedes aegypti vectors and the relative density of those mosquitoes in 50 cities across the southern United States. And we compared those to Miami, which is one of the most climatically suitable cities in the United States for dengue and chikungunya, and likely Zika as well. One of the other factors that we looked at was how many people are coming into the airports from areas where Zika transmission was occurring in February, which is when we were doing the analysis for the paper. And then the last one is just an assessment of where you have higher rates of poverty. And poverty could be related to transmission for multiple reasons, including potentially more waste and less disposal of trash items that might harbor water that can be good sources for the mosquitoes to lay their eggs.
So which of those U.S. cities did you find were most at risk?
So a couple of the places that we identified were, again, in southern Florida, as well as South Texas, in Brownsville, as well as Miami-Dade County. And those also have had a history of dengue and chikungunya transmission in the past as well. And dengue and chikungunya are transmitted by Aedes aegypti and Aedes albopictus, as well as Zika virus.
What did you find as far as Arizona cities go?
So Arizona cities, we showed that they are definitely suitable. They can support the Aedes aegypti vector, particularly after the monsoon season when there's enough rainfall to fill containers and allow the mosquitoes to lay their eggs and go through the development cycle. But that, it compared to places like Miami and southern Texas, the risk is lower.
Why is that?
There's multiple reasons. One is that the season is a bit shorter because you have precipitation that is sort of in a smaller time window. There's also just factors such as too hot a temperatures. So if you have climates that are really hot, it actually decreases the survival of the adult Aedes aegypti mosquitoes. Now, they're pretty clever mosquitoes, and so a lot of times they can find microhabitats within your yard, and they can shade themselves and cover themselves from that hot sun. But when you look at laboratory experiments, those really hot temperatures do decrease their survival.
Is it a safe assumption, do you think, that at some point most, if not all, of the U.S. will have Zika there?
I think that that is probably premature to say. I think that we do not even have Aedes aegypti or Aedes albopictus in every part of the United States. We are trying to get a better sense of where they actually are. One of the weaknesses right now in trying to identify high-risk areas is that a lot of jurisdictions don't actually do surveillance for Aedes aegypti and Aedes albopictus specifically. A lot of places have surveillance programs for the Culex mosquitoes, which transmit West Nile virus. But in terms of where you would place traps, the kinds of traps you might use, et cetera, those are different for Aedes aegypti and Aedes albopictus. So I think before we could say anything about where we might have really high transmission across, you know, all of the United States, we first need to know where we even have the mosquito.
Given the amount of attention that Zika has been generating, do you think that the areas that have not been doing surveillance yet are going to start doing it?
You know, I hope so. I hope that there is some funding and resources that gets passed so that they can actually have the capacity to do that. A lot of jurisdictions, the people who are in charge of doing mosquito surveillance are also doing restaurant inspections, and they're in charge of trying to do pest management for rodent control, et cetera. So they're spread pretty thin. So if we could get some funding to try and assist them in purchasing the traps that are specific to Aedes aegypti, as well as giving them a little more time to go in and run those traps, that would be ideal.
Casey Ernst is an associate professor in epidemiology in the College of Public Health at the University of Arizona. Governor Doug Ducey yesterday held a ceremonial bill signing ceremony for a new law making it easier for homeowners to rent out their places using services like Airbnb.
I'm not here to block new ideas and good ideas. I'm here to make it easier for entrepreneurs, business owners, and would-be entrepreneurs to get into business.
Ducey deflected criticism over potential concerns from neighbors who might not want short-term rentals nearby. This bill is part of an effort by the governor to move Arizona more into the so-called sharing economy, and some of those companies are starting to take note. Chris Lehane is Airbnb's head of global policy and communication and was in Phoenix for the signing ceremony.
I think it's a historic piece of legislation. I think it's historic for Arizona. I think it's a historic day in the sharing economy. It really reflects a state doing what it can to embrace the future and where economic growth is going to come from. And I think for our company, it's a historic day because this legislation really strikes the right balance in terms of doing everything it can to recognize and really unleash the power of home sharing while also balancing the various equities of cities, local governments, and the state.
You referenced unleashing the potential, and I'm curious what you think the ultimate potential for a company like Airbnb is here in Arizona.
First of all, I think it is a model legislation. And so for us, as we look at this bill, what's clear is that, you know, Arizona is going to be a state that we're going to want to work closely with, that we're going to want to partner with, that we're going to want to support, that we're going to want to promote. You know, it helps us be able to use our platform to be able to direct, steer, and promote Arizona as a destination, again, not just in the Southwest, not just in the United States, but globally.
One of the concerns that some critics of this bill brought up was that you could run into a situation where a number of neighbors in a particular area could rent out their homes on Airbnb, and what you would essentially end up with is a hotel in a residential neighborhood. I'm curious, from your perspective, how do you try to allay the concerns of folks who are worried about stuff like that?
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, what Arizona has done, I think, is really an effort to strike the right balance. It obviously recognizes the rights of homeowners and people to be able to use their home to generate that supplemental income and to attract tourists. While at the same time, I think giving cities and local governments, you know, flexibility that they need to be able to address health and safety types of concerns. There's some unbelievably great hotels in Arizona. Down the street from where I am is the Phoenician. If people want to go experience a wonderful hotel, they're going to go to the Phoenician. And so, you know, this idea of people sort of creating, in effect, hotels is not really consistent with our vision and our model and, in fact, what our platform looks like.
Well, you referenced the Phoenician, and obviously the Valley and, to a large extent, Arizona in general is kind of a resort area. I'm curious where you think sort of it'll ultimately play out as far as a role for Airbnb, a role for resorts, and a role for some of the other, you know, hotels and motels that are in town.
Yeah, it's a great question. We believe that all of these are complementary to one another. You know, if you look at tourism, even in what has been generally a globally stagnant economy, tourism is growing by approximately 15% a year. It's become a huge economic driver. And so from our perspective, you know, this is an economic space where hotels and resorts and home sharing can all live together and thrive together and complement one another.
Chris Lehane is head of global policy and communication for Airbnb.
It was 40 years ago today that the bombing of a car in downtown Phoenix sent a chill through the growing city and its journalists. Arizona Republic reporter Don Bowles' Datsun 710 was blown up in the middle of the day as he was going about his work. The sound of the explosion was captured by an attorney who happened to be recording his own dictation.
Stage would be for me to file.
John Winters was an investigative reporting colleague of Bowles at the Republic. He recently wrote about some of the memories of the event and what came next, and he joins me now. What was organized crime like in Phoenix back then? Did you and Bowles know about it?
Don, who had been doing investigative work for about 10 years, had actually started pulling back from doing that when he was killed. He had given me his card file on organized crime, and yes, it was replete with what you would call classic organized crime, I guess, the Chicago mob, New York, because there were elements of both of those entities in Arizona at the time. What did Bowles in was, I guess you'd call it local organized crime. In other words, there was a group of people who congregated at the bars along North Central Avenue. And to give you an idea of their mindset, after John Adamson, who made the phone calls that lured Bowles to the bombing, after his name appeared in the Republic, I was following him around and I would go into those bars. And not only was he not shunned, but he was championed. He was lionized. People were buying him drinks and, you know, toasting him. So obviously you've got a sizable minority of people who not only weren't offended by the murder, but thought it was cause for celebrity on the part of the murderer.
Did you feel like once it became so public, and then you're following these people, did you ever feel like you were in danger?
Well, I didn't feel it. I had been doing investigative work for a couple of years by then. And the simple fact is that if you're afraid or timid, you're totally ineffective. So gradually you build up kind of a hard shell. So not that you're totally without fear, but you mitigate it. You just don't allow it to affect what you're doing, because otherwise you'd be totally ineffective.
You tell a great story in one of many great stories in the piece you wrote for The Republic, and that involves your colleague Chuck Kelly with his dictionary. I wonder if you could tell that one. Because it sort of harkens back to asking whether you guys felt like you were in any more danger or not.
Yeah, that was kind of funny. And Chuck always had a dictionary in the car, and he was a very literate person, very good writer, so I always thought that was kind of funny. And then I picked it up one time, seemed kind of heavy, and I looked in and hollowed out in the center of the dictionary was a space where he had a handgun secured. Fortunately, we never had to use it, but Chuck at least It was probably a fairly cautious, fairly smart thing to do, because the people we were dealing with were a pretty horrendous lot.
I wonder, on the practical news level, if we look 4 or 5 years after that, was the name Don Bull still talked about a lot? Was it one of those things that if you had a new young reporter come in, people knew about this sort of thing, or until anniversaries come around, is it forgotten to some extent?
I think that's human nature. In other words, no, it wasn't as if he was a specter there in the newsroom all the time. And so, certainly, especially those who knew Bowles were reminiscent of him, but for the most part, people just tended to go on. It was maybe in the back of your mind somewhere, but not omnipresent.
John Winters, former colleague of Don Bowles. Bowles died 11 days after the explosion, following a series of operations to amputate one arm and both legs. Bowles had investigated organized crime for more than a decade and had made some enemies. The Republic staff tried to fill Bowles' void, turning their shock and anger toward work. Bob Early was a city editor at the paper and Don Bowles' boss.
When we found out that it was one of our guys, we mobilized the whole effort of reporting it. So there wasn't a whole lot of time to be shocked or to think about it.
Meanwhile, in Indianapolis, at the inaugural convention of the Investigative Reporters and Editors Organization, an unprecedented decision was made. The IRE would send a team to Arizona to follow up on Bowles' investigations. Newsday's Bob Green led the team. He says the reporters weren't going to try to solve Bowles' murder. Instead, they wanted to investigate and illuminate the conditions that led to it. They would try to use journalism as a weapon.
Here was a society that felt, at least some elements of it, felt it was permissible to kill a reporter to stop his work. Now, the question in our mind was to go out there and examine that society, particularly in light of what he had been working on.
Bob Early was glad the reporters were coming to Phoenix.
Any kind of show of strength, it seemed to me, would be beneficial for us so that these kind of things wouldn't happen again. The more heat that we could bring on to the criminal element as a result of this, and also, you know, to government and the politicians, would have been very beneficial to us.
Over the course of 6 months, 38 journalists worked on the project. Many of them had never met Bowles. Members teamed up to investigate the influence of organized crime in the state, from prostitution to illegal immigration to land fraud. 6 of the team members were involved from start to finish, but most could only commit to a couple of weeks. So Bob Green developed a system of cross-indexed files that would let newer reporters get up to speed quickly. The group's efforts drew attention in Arizona, and it also sparked high-profile interest from the CBS News magazine, 60 Minutes.
When they blew up an Arizona reporter named Don Bowles, they may have blown up a lot more than they bargained for.
It also got the attention of rival newspapers. The New York Times and the Washington Post said the project was misguided at best. Bob Green.
New York Times, Abe Rosenthal, who I had great, great respect for, said if this is to be done, it shouldn't be done collectively. The New York Times will do it. The Times didn't do it, so fortunately we did. Ben Bradley in the Washington Post opposed it. First statement he made was that investigative reporters cannot sit in the same room for more than 3 days without going at each other's throats. It'll never work.
But it did work. On March 13, 1977, newspapers across the country published the first of a 23-part series produced by the Arizona Project team. It chronicled alleged corruption in Arizona business and politics. But none of those stories appeared in Don Bowles' paper. Nina Pulliam, publisher of the Arizona Republic, made the decision. Former city editor Bob Early says the paper should have published the series.
What our publisher at the time was concerned about was the fact that we were going to publish things that were in some tone accusatory, and so they were concerned about legal action. I didn't have any concerns about that.
I was outraged.
Again, Bob Green.
Here was a newspaper that had been cooperating with us all the way along the line on the Bob Early level, which was the city editor level, and which all of a sudden now is saying they never had any part of the project.
Green wasn't alone in his anger. The general manager of local radio station KOY was stunned by the Republic's decision. So he decided the station should read the series on the air every night at 6:30 to keep Phoenix residents informed.
As a public service, KOY News now presents a comprehensive review of today's report by the Investigative Reporters and Editors Incorporated. Since today is
As a reporter for the Indianapolis Star, Myrta Pulliam was part of the Arizona Project. She was affected professionally and personally by the Republic's decision not to publish the series. The publisher was her grandmother.
You know, if somebody kills a reporter, this is the kind of attention that's going to get turned on you. People from all over the country are going to come out here, and you're going to be put under a microscope. And no criminal, no person in their right mind wants that to happen to them. I think that that worked. The fact that we were all there, there was so much attention, really was an insurance policy and still is to this day.
Three men were convicted in the Bowles killing: Max Dunlap, John Adamson, and James Robeson. Investigative Reporters and Editors Incorporated pursued the completion of Bowles' work through the Arizona Project, and since then, IRE has extended its reach. Mark Horvitt is IRE's executive director. Mark, there were some skeptics about whether investigative reporters from different publications could come together. How important is an example like the Arizona Project?
The Arizona Project itself has its own legacy, which is extended into the present day. There have been several cases internationally of things named similarly like the Arizona Project. There was the Chauncey Bailey Project, where a journalist in the San Francisco Bay Area was shot, and a group of local journalists gathered in the spirit of the Arizona Project and worked together to investigate what he'd been investigating, and in that case also to investigate the cause of his death. There was just a project called the Khadija Project, which occurred last year in Eastern Europe, for a journalist who wasn't murdered, but she was imprisoned for her work. They put together this project to do, again, to continue her work while she was imprisoned, and she was just released. So the project itself has a legacy of inspiring similar work for either murdered or imperiled journalists, with this idea of reporters coming together. And the real theme of this work, for the most part, is completing the work that they did. This isn't an instance of vengeance, and it's not the idea of trying to get revenge in some way. The message that the journalists were trying to send from IRE when they gathered in Phoenix 40 years ago was that you cannot kill the story by killing the reporter. They wanted to send a very explicit message because they didn't want this to become something that would be more common in the U.S. that would really put journalists at risk if somebody thought, well, I can just kill this person and I'll be safe.
How much of a legacy does the name Don Bowles have in the business in general? Certainly in Phoenix, you know, we're well-versed in what goes on. Is it still a name, whether it's the blown-up car at the museum? Is that still a name that when someone's in an investigative reporting situation, they know that name, or is it a lesson that still needs to be sort of taught?
I think it's a lesson that still needs to be taught. I think the Arizona Project has some legacy and some legs. And like you said, people who have been to the museum have seen the car. People who are members of IRE tend to know who Don Bowles was, though I venture to say that a lot of our newer, younger members probably don't. It's one of the reasons that we do the conference in Phoenix every 10 years is to make sure that people don't forget about what happened. But I think there is a constant need for this story to be remembered and told, like with so many things in history, because especially when you live in a country like this, where relatively speaking, it's pretty safe to be a journalist, it's easy to take a lot of things for granted.
Though people may say they dislike the media, they don't like reporters, whatever it is, why do you think it is that these tragic things happen at least so rarely here? Is there something built into our society or how, in general, people view the press, even at times when they get annoyed by it?
Yeah, I think so. I think that there's no history or legacy here of violence against the press to accomplish your means. I think that the press plays such a fundamental role in the founding and the structure of America, its government, its constitution, that it's one thing for people to say they hate the media or to not trust the media. There's lots of professions that people hate and don't trust, right? Journalists are only one of many. And so I think that's a far, far, far cry from wanting to kill reporters or imprison reporters or physically threaten them. But I think that the press's place in the history of the United States and in the fabric of the founding of the country probably makes a difference in the way people view the role of the media, even when they don't like us.
Mark Horvitt, Executive Director of Investigative Reporters and Editors Incorporated. We've been marking 40 years since the bombing of reporter Don Bowles' car in Phoenix.
It's the show on 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And with the takeaways, John Hockenberry, I'm Steve Goldstein. The Valley and other parts of Arizona and California will be under an excessive heat warning this weekend. Highs could reach 116 on Saturday.
So get ready to crank that AC.
It's so damn hot. Milk was a bad choice.
Summer weather is here, and don't think you have to endure heat and humidity like someone locked up in an airless attic.
This lucky baby will sleep quietly through the night. Yes, no matter how high the temperature goes outdoors, this baby's RCA air conditioner will keep his room filled with cool, dry, fresh air and keep that room so comfortable and quiet, he'll never need a middle-of-the-night lullaby.
No, think of air conditioning as the latest dance craze in India, like Bhangra music. AC is coming to Asia in a really big way. Even 5 years ago, just 5% of India's 1.25 billion people had AC. In 2011, 13% in Mexico, about the same as in China. But as the prices drop and demand grows in developing countries, a new estimate suggests 700 million new air conditioners are expected to be installed by 2030, rising to an extra 1.6 billion units by 2050. Multiply this by 700 million. The average air conditioning unit in the American home releases about 2 tons of carbon dioxide each year. Do the math. And that's what they're doing in San Francisco right now at something called the 7th Clean Energy Ministerial, all about how to lessen the climate impact from air conditioning. Derwood Zelke is there now. He's president of the Institute for Governance and Sustainable Development. Derwood, welcome.
Thank you.
Do people in Asia, particularly India, view air conditioning, as Americans have come to, and Europeans for that matter, as an entitlement, as, oh my gosh, where's the AC, the moment you walk into a room, and that to be denied air conditioning on some level because of regulations or efficiency standards that would be noticeable in the temperature would be politically significant?
Well, I think you can flip that around, John. Right now, it's the rich who have air conditioning in India. What happens is that they will turn on their inefficient machines when it gets hot. They'll crank up the cooling and it will strain the grid so much it will blow it out. They'll have brownouts and blackouts and energy will be deprived for everyone in the society. So if you make the machine super efficient, you're going to be able to make them available to a broader array of citizens who will need them in a warming world. It's been 123 degrees Fahrenheit in India just the last few days. It's a very, very hot, and people die at this temperature.
What's the technology that's required to make these super efficient air conditioners, and can you make a cooling scheme that doesn't rely so heavily on electricity that might be more sustainable and more, work the way old-style architecture would work in the desert, for instance?
There is technology, though, and we have on the market already. Japan has a requirement for top runner. They benchmark appliances, including air conditioners, that are the most efficient, and then they tell all other manufacturers, you have so many years to achieve this same level of efficiency, or you can't manufacture your appliance. China, which makes 70% of the world's air conditioners, is looking at this exact type of regulatory structure right now, and they're under a legislative mandate to improve their efficiency. The time to do this is right now because the world is going to change the refrigerants. Right now, we're using something called hydrofluorocarbons, or HFCs, and for the last several years, the countries of the world have debated amending the Montreal Protocol to phase down these refrigerants in favor of climate-friendly alternatives.
Is there a constituency that's pro-air conditioning, that's pushing back on this, that's going to make this a difficult consensus to reach?
Yes. It takes some patience. It takes some education, some insight to show ministers, for example, that these inefficient air conditioners are stealing their electricity. So Prime Minister Modi of India really faces a choice. Right now, people could say, well, you're providing air conditioning to the elite, and that is stealing energy from the 300 million people in India who have no access to energy. So, and because the growth curve for the air conditioning is so high, 10 to 15% in India, fastest growing region in the world, there'll be more energy devoted to this and less available to the 300 million who don't have it. So the Prime Minister can say, and I think his team is leaning in this direction, if we make these machines super efficient, we will save enough energy, according to Lawrence Berkeley, to avoid building up to 1,600 medium-sized peak power plants just by 2030. And that energy we can then share more equitably with people who don't now have access to it.
Derwood Zelke is at the 7th Clean Energy Ministerial Meeting. He's president of the Institute for Governance and Sustainable Development and participating in that event. Derwood Zelke, keep cool and good luck with the making progress.
Thank you, John.
That's John Hockenberry at The Takeaway.
The Supreme Court is expected to rule this month on a legal challenge to the Obama administration's immigration programs for young people who came to the U.S. as children and their parents. And until they do, many families here in Arizona are left waiting to learn their fate. But the Arizona Dream Act Coalition wants them to be ready.
We really have high hopes that we're going to have a ruling in our favor. And if that's the case, we don't want our community to have to wait.
Dream Act Coalition President Karina Ruiz says they're working to get the word out to their community about the impending decision to help prepare immigrant families here for the outcome. And the show's Lauren Gilger spoke with her. Lauren, first, can you fill us in on what led to this?
Sure. So you might remember in 2012 when President Obama announced his executive action on immigration called Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, which is a program to give temporary legal status and work permits to young people who came to the U.S. as children. Then in 2014, he announced the expansion of that program and the Deferred Action for Parents of Americans and Lawful Permanent Residents, or DAPA, which gives their parents temporary work permits and permission to stay in the U.S. These programs could provide deportation relief for more than 5 million people in the country now, according to the Dream Act Coalition, but they are on hold because 26 states, including Arizona, joined a lawsuit challenging the president's authority to do this. That's the Supreme Court decision we're expecting this month. So Ruiz and the Arizona Dream Act Coalition says they want families to be ready for a positive or a negative outcome for them.
If we have a negative decision, this is not the end of it. We can still prepare to do something else. You know, what are going to be our next steps? And so we can really regroup. And even though it might be tough to hear that, we have to be ready.
And what can families do now before they even know what the Supreme Court will decide?
A lot, actually. If the Supreme Court decides to let the programs go forward, the application process isn't easy. Based on the requirements for the original DACA program, Ruiz says they'll have to prove that they have continuously lived in the U.S. since probably January of 2010, that they were present in the country on the day the program was announced in 2014. They can't have a felony on their record or some misdemeanors. So they'll have to get a lot of information together.
Any document, essentially, that has the person's name, that has a date, you know, of the period that we're trying to prove that they have been here, if they can at least get one or two documents that show when they came into the U.S., their medical records, their tax records, I mean, the library records, Facebook, if they checked in and it says Phoenix, they're able to use.
And what kinds of questions are they getting from families?
Ruiz says they ask about the basics, the cost, the requirements, who's eligible, but they're also scared.
What if we are able to implement the program and then immigration decides to take away the program or the next president does? People are really worried about that because then they think, well, immigration now has my information. What are they going to do with it? You know, that fear of deportation now that immigration could have their information. I think that people don't really trust, and that's why it's hard also to get people to apply to these kind of programs.
But she says they tell them it's worth applying.
We tell people that the benefits really outweigh the cons. You know, let's take it a step at a time and let's just take advantage of the program while we have it for DACA. And if we're able to implement those other executive orders, then let's take advantage of that. Because that will help us, you know, set a foundation and have at least an argument that we're contributing to the economy.
That's Karina Ruiz with the Arizona Dream Act Coalition. She's working to help families here in Arizona prepare for the Supreme Court's upcoming decision on the president's expanded deferred action policies.
And that's the show's Lauren Gilger. Lauren, thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
Blowing dust is nothing new to Arizona. We've got dust devils, and the monsoon season will bring haboobs.
But recently, a man-made problem has been kicking up clouds and causing trouble on a major state highway. The show's Jimmy Jenkins reports on the dust-up.
Kevin Rogers is a fourth-generation farmer with operations all over the valley. He's standing in the middle of a freshly cut field in Scottsdale.
So this is a triticale. It's, as you can see, it's kind of a grain, almost a millet-looking type of feed.
Soon, this wheat-like crop will be processed into feed for dairy cows. A combine has just rolled by to cut the slender stalks, leaving behind stubble in the field, like a green 5 o'clock shadow.
The idea is to leave as much organic matter on the soil as you can so it doesn't, you know, blow away.
But that's exactly what happened on a stretch of farmland near San Simone last month. A landowner named David Turner bulldozed more than 1,000 acres of virgin soil, in some places as deep as 3 feet. Rogers says in farming, you're bound to make mistakes, but as far as screw-ups go?
I would say this is pretty major.
The nature of this dust is that it is extremely fine and it creates a major hazard in terms of visibility. Particulate matter in the air also can be a public health risk.
Caroline Oppelman with the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality says her department contacted the landowner after complaints started rolling in. The dust made it hard to breathe and hard to see. It was so bad that the Department of Transportation closed a 60-mile stretch of the I-10 7 times in a matter of weeks after multiple accidents. Oppelman says the landowner was initially slow to comply, but eventually agreed to do something about the dust.
So what we did is we filled these water trucks up with water, and then we added in our Gorilla Snot concentrate.
That's right, Gorilla Snot. Chad Falkenberg runs a Scottsdale company called Soilworks that produces, among other things, a dust-containing polymer, almost like a milky white glue, called Gorilla Snot.
It self-mixes inside of the tank, and then they simply drive to the area and spray it out over the surface of the ground, where we're creating a thin crust to cap off everything.
Soilworks was one of 2 companies contracted to deal with the dust. The state and the landowner have spent more than $400,000 containing the problem. Falkenberg says they used more than 40,000 gallons of Gorilla Snot on one of the worst cases of soil erosion he's ever seen.
Literally, there was moon dust up to your knees. You step in it and it just billows out from where you're walking. I'd never experienced conditions that dusty before.
Soilworks normally works on mining, construction, and Defense Department projects. They've helped build roads in Sudan and runways in Afghanistan. While Falkenberg thinks this is the first time his product has ever been used in an agricultural setting, he says the polymer is biodegradable and environmentally safe, and the crust should keep the dust in check for as much as a year until the landowner decides to plant his first crop. Farmer Kevin Rogers hopes that when he does, he'll seek advice on soil conservation.
We want to make sure they get cover crops on that virgin property, and we want to make sure that their sprinklers are up and running as quickly as they can be, that they've got their wells fired up, and so we're here to help them, if they'd like it, to make sure that they're using some of the practices that make sense for their part of the country.
No word yet on whether the state will seek damages against the landowner. Oppelman from DEQ says they're still waiting on the dust to settle. Jimmy Jenkins, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
My name is Ryan Worling. I'm here at American Pancration Fighting. Right now, we're doing some MMA drills, some basic stand-up, Dutch kickboxing, boxing, wrestling, jiu-jitsu.
1, 2. 1, 2, 3, 4.
The best way to get in shape, because it's not like running, where it just uses just your legs. It's your entire body.
Yeah. Pull, use your momentum.
And also learning how to twist your body mechanics. I've seen a 120-pound girl knock out a 250-pound meathead because she knows how to twist her body just the right way.
Bonk, bonk, and he moves back. Push it back.
While I do have a career aspirations for law enforcement, if I could someday go professional mixed martial arts, that would be a dream come true.
That's Ryan Worling, training at American Pancration Fighting in Tempe. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or just want to give us a spinning heel kick, send us a note, the show, at kjzz.org.
This is Verde Park at 9th Street and Van Buren in Phoenix. Birds chirp in the trees and kids ride by on skateboards. And tonight and tomorrow, the park will host Rising Youth Theater in performances called Under the Rug. The three plays will delve into living room stories. Each has two directors, one adult and one child. To get a sense of what the shows are all about, I spoke with Matthew Mendez. He just finished his sophomore year at the Metropolitan Art Institute in Phoenix, and his co-director, Lily Gomez, as well as Sarah Sullivan, one of Rising Youth Theater's co-artistic directors.
We are really interested at Rising Youth Theater in moving theater outside of traditional theater spaces and engaging the community through not just the work that we create, but the geography of that work, which we were really excited about this project and the idea of creating creating plays out of stories that happen in neighborhoods, in people's living rooms, in people's home spaces, and then popping up these performances in spaces that are not these intimate personal home spaces, but extremely public, a public park.
Matthew, what was it like sort of talking to people who are strangers to you, who, you know, you're trying to, in some ways, it sounds like maybe get some sort of intimate family details from that you're going to incorporate into a play?
Well, at first I was a little nervous because I have never really been one to make conversation, but because I knew that we were getting valuable information from these families and we were going to use them to create an artwork, it kind of made me more comfortable, and I was able to gain the confidence to ask these people about their living room and about their lives in the living room.
What were some of the things that you learned that maybe surprised you?
How different every family is. I know that not every family, of course, acts the same, but I have never really thought of how they would be different. So listening to these stories and listening to how people live in the living room really surprised me, because they said things or mentioned things that I never really thought someone would do in the living room.
Sarah, is there a hope that by talking to people in the communities in which you're going to be performing, that sort of gives them incentive to come out and see the show?
Yeah, I absolutely think that. For me, I think it's less about incentivizing people to come and more about what we can do as we're creating a play to build a sense of ownership and generate that sense of, this is about the place where I live, this is for me, this is for my family, and I have that investment to come and be a part of it and hear these stories and share more stories. We'll work with, as we publicize the show, we'll push people to bring their own stories, family photos, objects from their living rooms to the show to help us continue to tell this story even as these performances are set, but the conversation doesn't end with the performance.
What do you hope to get out of that kind of audience engagement? What kind of discussion would you like to be having?
Well, I'm really interested in the way the conversations we have across generations and the way adults and youth talk to each other. So as we have these conversations, we're going to have our ensemble, our performers and our directors of all ages out. We don't have a backstage because we're in a park. So everyone will be out with the audience as people are coming in. And I think opening up to those conversations, it's really powerful, I think, to be asked about your story.
Lily, did you feel any additional pressure putting together a show, knowing that the people, you know, the stories are roughly based on, could be sitting, you know, 5 feet away from your actors and actresses putting the show on?
A little bit of yes and more no. I think a little bit of yes, because it's, you know, people's stories and it's an intimate thing. A living room setting is an intimate place for everyone and everyone in their households. No, because Rising Youth Theater does a really great job connecting stories with youth and adult artists and creating something specifically for the community.
Did you feel like you had to take maybe more care with the stories, knowing that, as you say, they were very intimate stories from people who are intimately familiar and connected to the place in which you'll be performing?
Yes. I feel that there was a moment in the piece where I had to stop for a minute and be like, wait, is this okay or is this not okay? And then make a judgment to go further into it.
Sarah, I have to ask you logistically, this is not obviously a theater. Your company is known for not putting on performances in theaters, as you discussed. What are some of the logistical issues that you have to deal with being in an open field in a public park?
Well, I think the first thing is really a community respect issue of making sure that we are connecting with the Parks Department, connecting with the neighborhood, that we are partnering with this space and not coming in and taking over this space and saying, like, we're doing theater, enjoy it, you're stuck. So we put a lot of time in making sure that those partnerships are there. And in terms of the logistics, there's a lot of things that we get really used to having as theater artists. Lights, sound. We are in this park where it would be very expensive to bring in a lot of lighting equipment. So we are making really intentional choices about where we position our set so that we can use the stadium lighting that comes with the geography of the space. We need to think about where our actors get changed and make sure people come in costume if we don't have access to dressing rooms. And we need to really think about what happens to take care of both of our artists and our audiences to make sure that everybody knows what's happening, feels safe, knows what's going on all of the time.
Now, obviously, performance in a park is not necessarily unique. I mean, you hear about Shakespeare in the Park and other performances. Are there things that you can draw from those kinds of performances that you can use to your advantage here, or maybe just help you figure something out here?
Absolutely. I think some of it is just that context building, right? As you say, theater in a park is something that is familiar, so people have an understanding of what that might look like, and then our opportunity here is to take that perception of what theater in a park is and make it something that's really unique to this neighborhood, to Rising Youth Theater, and to our community.
I want to ask each of you about, Matthew and Lily, about just sort of being in these two communities. Is there any significance? I know, Lily, you said you live nearby. Is there any significance to you doing this here?
Huge. It's significant. Huge because it's giving back to a community that's growing and thriving and has a ton of culture that has been here long enough to have said, like, we created this area, you know. It's giving them a voice of empowerment. It's giving something back to kids in the neighborhood that are interested in the arts. It's opening the eyes to them to do something like that. So I think this is huge to be doing this in both of these neighborhoods.
And Matthew, you don't live in either of the neighborhoods where you'll be performing, but it sounds like you've sort of gotten to know these neighborhoods and the people who live there.
Yeah, I think that it is significant that we're performing in these areas because we have based our plays on the stories from people in these areas. So I think that creating this beautiful piece of art or theater is really giving back to them in a positive way, to know that there are people that actually are interested and care for the people in these neighborhoods.
That's Matthew Mendez, one of the directors of Under the Rug and a student at the Metropolitan Art Institute in Phoenix. We also heard from his co-director, Lily Gomez, as well as Sarah Sullivan, one of Rising Youth Theater's co-artistic directors. Their performances will be tonight and tomorrow night at Verde Park in Phoenix's Garfield neighborhood, and Saturday and Sunday nights in Phoenix's Coronado Park. A new list of the 20 most charming college towns in the U.S. just came out from the apartment-finding website Rentlingo. My college town, Syracuse, did not make that list.
But both Flagstaff and Tempe did, and the most charming streets were Aspen Avenue in Flagstaff and Mill Avenue in Tempe. The show's Annika Klein took a walk down Mill to see if people in town felt the ranking stacked up.
I really like it. There's a lot of things to do. There's a lot of bars. There's a lot of people everywhere.
Nothing really compares to it because it has so much color, like right here where we're standing right now.
That's Danielle Gajewski and Joe Pitts. Both stepped onto Mill Avenue for the first time this week. Gajewski just moved here, and Pitts is visiting from Dallas. And that first impression was striking. Lots of local stores, brick walkways lined with deep green trees, restaurant patios. These factors are exactly what the creators of Rentlingo use to measure a neighborhood's charm. Co-founder Dan Laufer calls it the Charm Index.
Pulling in data on crime, data from maps, so we can identify things like parks and bike trails, you know, things like libraries.
Laufer finds areas with the most positive factors, like parks, and the lowest crime rates. He and his co-founder tested their algorithm on focus groups of people in different cities. But Laufer does admit,
we haven't actually been to a lot of the places.
So what Laufer and other outsiders might not know is that Mill has changed a lot over the past couple decades. In the 90s, it was known as an incubator for local music and art, and the street was lined with many locally owned small businesses. Many people see it differently now. Tucked in the back of a courtyard is a tiny shop called Yucatecan Imports. It has trinkets from dozens of countries, and it's been here for 18 years. Barbara Polson is behind the counter today.
We've seen a lot of changes, and I don't think for the good, personally.
Polson says a lot of quirky, small shops have already left, partly because of higher rents, the price of Mill's growing popularity.
Well, if you walk up and down the street, most of the businesses are bars and restaurants. Mm-hmm. There's not that many little shops anymore.
As she sees it, the charm has been on its way out for some time. In many of the old brick buildings now, you'll see chain businesses, and beyond those are new high-rises.
That's something that's, to me, kind of troubling because that also pushes people out who have lived here for years.
Gabe Berry is walking down Mill with Emily Johnson, both recently graduated from Arizona State University. The large campus a few blocks away is what makes this a college town, but Johnson points out that might be part of why the charm is hard to hold on to.
I feel like student populations tend to be really, like, transient. So, like, a student is not expecting to be here for more than, like, their 4 years of education. The people who are going to be the most invested in, like, maintaining the historical buildings and stuff are going to be people who, like, have their roots planted really deep in this area.
And those are the people who have seen Mill Avenue change, which may make charm a relative term, one that's not so easily measured. For the show, I'm Anika Klein.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.